brought to you by Laura Hesker and Lou Mensa. This week, we're delighted to have our first guest, Stephen Riley, on the show. Stephen is the founder of MixedRaceStudies.org, which is a website offering scholarly perspectives on the mixed race experience.
Shade Social. I want to start with a really touching set of tweets from last week. For anyone that missed it, they were posted by Soledad O'Brien. She's an American broadcast journalist, executive producer, and currently the anchor of a political show in the US. She shared the news of her father Edward O'Brien's passing on Twitter in a series of tweets celebrating his life. In these tweets, Soledad shared her dad's commitment to civil rights. Edward, she tweeted, who was white, was not only a family man, but someone who believed everyone was equal. He was a generous and kind human being and a quiet force fighting for civil rights. His marriage to my mom in 1958 was illegal. She's black. They were married 59 years. He and my mum were asked by the ACLU to be the couple that would test the ban on interracial marriage. They declined. He was working on his PhD, worried he wouldn't be able to finish. Tributes poured in via Twitter from major civil rights activists celebrating the life of her father. It's mad to think this is also the time that my late father and mum were married in the UK. They faced so many challenges resulting from their relationship, some of which still affect the family today. Broken friendships and family ties from back when they were engaged. A hesitancy from that generation to talk about the struggles that they faced. Another reason why this podcast seems so important to create is one of its kind in this country, and we want to chat not only about current news stories, but historical and personal ones too.
Shade Culture. I came across a book titled Black Enough: Stories of Being Young and Black in America. And this book is a collection of short stories about what it's like to be a young black person in America. These compelling stories range from kids who have been told they're acting white to kids that are mixed race and other complexities that come with racial identity in today's culture. I get the feeling it's going to be similar to Good Immigrant. I haven't read it yet, as it's only been released in the US on the 8th of Jan.
Okay, so most of us have Netflix, and we're including that in our culture section this week. And they've produced a new drama, Always a Witch, with false advertising that quite rightly caused problems for many following its release online. It was launched on February the 1st at the beginning of Black History Month in the States. It was advertised as a story of a 19-year-old 17th century Afro-Latina witch. However, what they didn't advertise in the trailer was the premise of the story, which is that Carmen was a slave in a relationship with her owner who brought her to save her. The original novel, Yol Brujah, which means I Witch, came out in 2015, which is a shock in itself. One wonders why it's necessary to produce a story with this premise and why Netflix would hide this main storyline in the trailer. We also wonder if they were being deliberately controversial to create publicity around the show, or if they were just so utterly lacking in imagination that they cannot see the social ramifications and backlash that would come from launching this story. Without the slave owner storyline, it could have been a wonderful coming of age series. Netflix have gone and shot themselves in the foot with this one. It caused a real furore on Twitter. Lots of people tweeted about it, including one tweet here, which I'll read out. And it says, watching Always a Witch, and I see exactly why a lot of this was kept out of the promo. I don't even feel comfortable with this plot. You all love making slaves fall in love with their masters, and you all knew exactly what you all were doing with not putting any of that in the trailers. I'm surprised if this show will last, actually. But maybe the context will go over the heads of the majority of the Netflix audience, I don't know. But when I was going through the tweets and trying to ascertain the reaction to this show, that tweet that I just read out was actually replied to by no other than Ja Rule. And I don't know why he replied to this particular tweet, but it made me laugh. So she was saying that she's not comfortable with it. And Ja Rule replied, "I too was hustled, scammed, bamboozled, hoodwinked and led astray." So basically he was referring to his experience with being hoodwinked by the creator of the Fyre Festival. Why he's relating it to this show, I don't know, but I just thought it was hilarious that it was the first time that Ja Rule had piped up for a while after this whole Netflix situation. Anyway, let's see what happens. I don't know if I'm going to check out this story or not, but if you have watched it, can you message in to us and let us know what you think? So the last part of the Shade Culture section is dedicated to Grace Wales Bonner, not just for her continually stunning rise and acclaimed status in the fashion industry, but for her current exhibition showing at the Serpentine Sackler Gallery in London. It's titled A Time for New Dreams, and the title nods to Ben Okri's book of the same name. And the exhibition is said by Bonner to transverse the themes of spirituality, mysticism, rhythm, and temporality. Grace's exhibition is the first at the Serpentine, curated by a fashion designer, and it presents the first in a new series of unique projects linking and honouring her African and Caribbean ancestors, with help from artists turned collaborators like American photographer Paul Sepua and painter Eric N. Mack. She said, "It's a space for meditation and reflection. It's to connect with ideas of history and ancestors' lineage, but it's also very global and open in its approach. So it's more of a place to reflect on how engaged with ideas we are, both physically and bodily, but also mentally and spiritually." In this show, Grace sees fashion as an intuitive means to understanding her own heritage. Anything Grace does is obviously wicked. The exhibition is free. It's on until the 16th of February, so you might have missed it. If you don't get a chance to see it or you haven't been able to catch it, then all the images and some of the amazing vintage videos she's got as part of the exhibition, they're all up online. They'll be on the Serpentine's website and also there on Grace's Instagram. But we had to give it a special mention, so check it out.
Shade Stories. Last week, a story written by John Kelly for the BBC website caught my eye. It was titled, "The Day I Went to Prison, I Got My Life Back." It caught my eye for two reasons. Firstly, because it happened close to home, and secondly, because the lady whom it was about, Lily Lewis, is mixed race. The article explains how the abuse she receives as a child on the playground shaped her future, and how this left her open and more vulnerable to a difficult life and a series of events which led to jail time. As always, links to the article will be in the show notes.
And now for Shade Across the Pond. So this is an interesting piece, which I feel ambiguous about, actually, but let me know what you think about this story. The Gleaner, which is a Jamaican newspaper, features a piece on reggae singer Queen Ifrika talking about colorism in her latest single, which is called Color of Rejection. She said it was written following last year's wedding of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, and it focuses on what she calls a somewhat black woman marrying a prince. It's interesting to me how she uses the term somewhat black woman. It's these reductive definitions that contribute to the on the sidelines position of mixed race people, but let's move on. She quotes, In the song, I spoke of Michelle Obama going to the White House and not leaving it the way she got it. Michelle is the perfect example of black women with excellent potential, but still had to struggle. Even as the first lady of a first world country, she was still being called a monkey and a man because they did not accept her as a black sister in the White House. Oprah Winfrey, another great dark-skinned sister, was also criticised, but she knew what she had and did not stop until she was on top of the world by accepting herself. All right, so that's her quote in this article. No mention of Meghan, but it seems like seeing Meghan in a prominent position publicly sparked her inspiration to write about colorism. I mean, I don't know anyone who would want to be in Meghan's public position, but anyway, that's not the point. We know that Meghan has been written about in the press with clear racial prejudice in a way that Kate Middleton, for example, has not. We know how she's been treated by some of the family members, for example. Do you remember those paparazzi images of Princess Michael of Kent when she was donning her blackamoor brooch off to lunch with Meghan? She apologised for that, but it was still a terrible, terrible mark of her thoughts on the marriage of Harry and Meghan. I was disgusted by it, and I thought it was a clear message to Meghan, which clearly shows that even within her new family setup, she has to deal with this kind of shit. I, for one, understand the passive-aggressive ways that racism rears its ugly head in seemingly favourable, nice, you know, circles, but don't tell me that Meghan's been let off the hook regarding racism. Don't at us with the brooch wasn't a racist statement and that Meghan didn't suffer racism because she's light-skinned, because she did. And she does every single day of the week when she's reported on in the press. So back to the DJ Ifrica story. She says that the song was penned around the time that her sister, DJ Spice, was talking about colorism on social media. She recently created a storm after posting images of herself with intentionally lightened skin to highlight these issues within the black community. It was a publicity stunt to denounce colorism. She said, "Do I believe if I was lighter, I'd get more corporate sponsorship? Yeah, I believe so. Do I believe I'd get more support from the corporate world? Yes, I believe so." She says the discrimination occurs in Jamaica, but she actually didn't experience it when she was working in the States. So my thoughts on this story is that basically it's an example of the complications regarding the experiences of racism within the diaspora. And sometimes there's a division between what people deem the most serious examples of racism that they've experienced. Do you know what? There's just racism. There's not any good racism or bad racism. There's not like a hierarchy of racism. It's just racism. But that was just an interesting story and quite a controversial one.
Last year, while doing a press conference for the film Widows, Viola Davis expressed that her interracial love scene with Neeson was important for promoting inclusion and diversity in Hollywood. She stated, "The film begins with me in bed with Liam Neeson and we're kissing, and it's a sexualized kiss. Here I am, I'm dark, I'm 53, I'm in my natural hair, and I'm with Liam Neeson. And with what America would consider to be a hunk. He's not my slave owner, I'm not a prostitute, and we are simply a couple in love, and I've never seen that before." Fast forward to this year, I'm not going to give that man's words any more airtime, but unfortunately it seems Widows was another Hollywood fantasy when it comes to interracial relationships. I hope they don't repeat this mistake in the future by casting another racist in a story which supposedly depicts positive interracial relationships.
And it's time for our special accolade, which goes to someone within our community who we respect, whether their work has been recent or historical. And this episode, we want to talk about Naina Cherry. Last October, she launched her fifth album, Broken Politics. Natural Skin Deep is a single from this album, which she released last week. We wanted to mention her amazing contribution to us as mixed race women. She gave us a wicked icon to identify with since back in the day. We all remember Raw Like Sushi, released in 1989, which won high acclaim largely due to the mega single Buffalo Stance, which still remains iconic to this day. I was checking out some of the interviews that she's done recently for the release of the album and the new single. And in a recent Guardian interview with Sam Wolfson, Naina talks about how she copes with the world and her place in it as a mixed race woman through her creativity. She says, "Music is the only weapon I carry. Sometimes the political begins with self-examination." Her biological father is from Sierra Leone and her mother is Swedish. And she talks about this by saying, the journey that he made coming to Sweden in the early 60s and making a life there, learning the language, fighting to be accepted, it's a big thing he did. Imagine when he went out in the street in the light of day, there's no black people there. The interviewer continues by asking if she thinks that as a mixed race female artist, she's got a short thrift from the mostly white male critics. And she said, yeah, but now it's like if you're not thinking inclusively, you're going to get wiped out. Even in the last 4 years, so much has happened. The Me Too, the Black Lives Matter movement, and there's been a lot more dialogue, but still with actors, filmmakers, musicians, it's still so male dominated. It's crazy. There's been these little ghettos for black music, black film, but it's like, here's a couple of things that can get through. It's too late for that now. The conversation has created a reaction, and the reaction is creating change. You start to see things for what they are. Truer words were never spoken, and just with this new album that's come out, all the memories have come back about how important she was to us growing up. So Naina is and will always be a queen. And before we round up, let's big up her daughter, Mabel, who's been nominated for a Brit this year. And now I'm delighted to introduce our first guest, which is Stephen Riley, who is the founder of mixedracestudies.org, which offers scholarly perspectives on the mixed race experience. We mentioned him in our first episode, and we are really excited to share this interview with you. Enjoy! Welcome to the podcast, Stephen. We're absolutely delighted to have you speak with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me across the pond.
What influenced you to start the process of sharing your research with the world?
I'm in my 10th year right now. I started in 2009. And I started the website because I had a sort of an interest in the topic of multiraciality.
Yeah.
And that came about, I would have to say, with the election of Barack Obama as president. Of course, he identifies as black, but his mixed race ancestry was sort of interesting. And I was influenced really by a podcast that's no longer around called Mixed Chicks Chat. Mm-hmm. And it was a podcast that you could sort of, visitors could sort of get in and chat online, and then they would have various hosts. And that was created by Fanchon Cox and Heidi DeRoe, who's an author, and Fanchon Cox is a producer and actress. And I was really fascinated in the topic. I learned a lot from them. They had an audio resource that was available to people every week. And of course they had the archive, but I wanted to do something that was more more text-based, you know, resources and links to the internet. So I couldn't find one, so I created one, and I started with an academic focus because I wanted to move away from the pop media sort of attention grabbing fascination with mixed race and sort of look at the history and fact and remind people that so-called mixing, or as I like to call it, family formation across racialized boundaries, because race is a social construct, it's not biological. And I wanted to do that. So I first thought that people might laugh and ignore it because I'm not an academic. I work in information technology. I'm also not mixed race. I'm Black man married to a white woman in the Washington area. And that sort of also influenced my interest in that. Yes. And before I knew it, there were people, I thought my audience would be at first people in the ordinary public, but it turns out that a lot of the people who follow my site are academia.
Right. And
I was a little shocked. And a few, you know, I think even before a year, someone came to my site, a person who has been very instrumental in helping me get off the board, is a professor named Reiner Spencer at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, who sort of really, you know, inspired me and sort of influenced me. Another one was G. Reginald Daniel, another sociology professor at University of California, Santa Barbara. And I really, really was interested in the topic. I was really interested in meeting, for example, Dr. Spencer. And he said, you know, one day back in, I think, 2011, 2010, he came into Washington, D.C. And he said, I said, well, let's meet for coffee before your event. And he turned to me and he said, well, I'm too busy. You know, I try to save money by coming in and flying out the same day. Why don't you meet me the day of the conference? Or in fact, why don't you present at my presentation?
Wow, that was a sharp rise.
That was a shock to me. Yeah. So I my presentation was simply about my site and what inspired me to do the site, but that was the beginning. And since then, I've been at multiple conferences, and I've delivered at each and every of the critical mixed race studies conference, and you know. And now at this point, my website gets about, I want to say, 3,000 visitors a day.
Right.
And something like, I'm going to say, yeah, about, yeah, 3,000 visitors a day.
What a major success. You couldn't have predicted this at the beginning, you know?
No. And I get maybe 2 million hits a month. So this is, it's incredible. And I've gotten just... there's a woman I'm sure you know named Emma DeBeery.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I've actually reached out to me, or we reached out to each other, and she said when she did her work on mixed race, she said I was the most instrumental site in her work. You know, she used that. So I just didn't know. And it was fascinating.
I'm really interested to hear that when you talk at conferences or when you're interviewed, there must be a set of key questions or points of interest that people really want to know that's come from your 10 years of work in this area. Do any of those come to mind at the moment, what people are really interested in with regards to your research and your work?
Certainly there is the history of mixed race, certainly in the Americas, and people are surprised to know about mixed race families from the early 17th century, you know, people who lived freely before slavery sort of took a foothold in places like Virginia and Maryland. People are surprised about that. They think, some people think mixed race is sort of a relatively new thing, and in fact, it is not. And I point to a fairly recent book about Jamaica by a guy named Daniel Livesay. And he talks about how slave traders in Jamaica, you know, way back in the 17th century, would send some of their mixed race children, particularly their boys, back to the metropole or the UK and have them raised there. So another thing that another issue and a side note, I like to preface the fact that, you know, over the centuries, I mean, over the last centuries, scientists, anthropologists have realized that that race was socially created.
Yes.
And particularly had to be created during, you know, 400 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we're pretty much in that anniversary, that 4th century anniversary, I should say, of the creation of slavery in in North America.
Yes.
And they had to create a distinction between who could be enslaved and who could not be enslaved.
Yes.
So all these things got created. So we have to realize that there is no, you know, that race is problematic. Another topic that's often gets discussed within the context of mixed race is the relationship to whiteness. You know, whiteness is often not spoken about when we talk about mixed race, and especially when people who are quote unquote mixed with a non-white, you know, mixture, and as if they don't count in some instances. And also there are interesting dynamics for people who are mixed white and Asian, you know, whether or not they would sort of assimilate into whiteness. You know, at some point 150 years ago in America, people who were Irish or Italian were not necessarily considered white.
Yes, absolutely.
And that sort of changed over time. And so those kind of dynamics are there. And of course, a big one here, I joined a couple of Facebook groups and a lot of contention around the discussion of the freedom to identify, who's seen as what, particularly for people who are black-white mixtures.
Absolutely.
So a whole lot of debate over, you know, Barack Obama's identity or you know, if he was wrong for identifying as black or what. And of course, now with the you know, we're going to head into the Democratic primaries. Kamala Harris,
Senator
of California, is in there.
Yes.
And she has tried to be as coy as possible by identifying as American.
Yes.
But it seems from most people's perspective is that she identifies as African American.
Yes, absolutely. We covered that in the last episode, actually, where she was interviewed, and it was, you know, it was a politically based interview, but actually the interviewer was just absolutely focused on her identity and how she self-identified, and she said, you know, I'm a proud black woman. I've been raised as a black woman. I'm African American, and there was no mention of there was no question. There was no moving out of that self description, and I just found that very interesting.
Yeah, and I think also what people don't often understand. I think if you look at some of the early, really recent scholars of multiracial identity, and multiracial identity covers many facets of academic discipline, but particularly, you know, sociology, obviously, but another big one is psychology.
Yes.
And a very prominent psychologist was Maria P.P. Root, who sort of came up with her sort of what she called mixed race bill of rights for people, you know, bill of rights for people of mixed heritage. And one of them was to have the right to identify any way they want within any different within any different context. So we often forget that Kamala Harris, that identification as an African American woman might change with her college classmates, might change with her neighbors. She might have a more maybe Indian identity. So she is running for public office, and she's a political candidate, And she gets a lot more political capital from African Americans because they simply outnumber people who are Indian American in the United States. So she's making a, I would say, shrewd political decision, just like President Obama did when he ran. Now, maybe at some point when he writes his memoirs and when she writes her memoirs, we'll get a different facet of her identity. Who knows?
Her identity at the moment seems to be questioned more than maybe I'm wrong in thinking this, but more than Obama's was.
Yes, yes. And of course, Obama was an activist in Chicago, where he sort of developed his, shall we say, credentials as a Black activist. So it was a little different than Kamala Harris, who developed her credentials as a prosecutor and putting people into jail and controversially putting people into jail. So we'll have to see how that develops.
It's Black History Month in the States at the moment. So you're halfway through Black History Month now.
Yes.
I did read a mention just now, so this must be just appearing in the news, something to do with Colin Kaepernick.
Yes.
What was the latest with him? He was
latest news was in the state of Wyoming, the Republican Party forced the Democratic Party to remove his name to vote on a resolution commemorating Black History Month. They had to remove his name.
Yeah.
So this pretty ugly, I think, definitely. He's very obviously a very controversial figure. He is someone, of course, of mixed parentage, who fully identifies as Black. And
absolutely.
And in that context, I just want to touch on that a little bit. Mm. When it comes to political activism, for social justice, there really isn't a lot of history of people who are mixed or identified clearly as mixed fighting for those things. Not that people didn't exist by any means, but if you're looking back for, a historical context, there's Black history, there's Latino history, there's Asian Americans fighting for social justice, not so much mixed. And I think there was a real hope with the ascension of Barack Obama to the presidency that might change.
Yes.
But during his administration, and of course now in the last 2 years, that has not been the case.
Yes, absolutely.
And the idea somehow that we become post-racial, just not even close. So I think you're seeing a lot of a regression, a lot of people, who are still identifying as mixed and still proudly, but still holding on to the idea that when it comes to activism, it pays to identify as Black if you want to get some social justice. It pays to look back at, social justice figures like Martin Luther King, like anyone, and so many people, including Malcolm X, who had known white ancestry, comes in the play. Another point of contention too is that people who are African American, by and large, are people who are descended from, who have European descendants.
Yes.
So in many ways, to be African American in the United States is to be mixed if you want to hold on to those racial labels.
Yes. Absolutely.
There isn't a person there. My last name, Riley, clearly came from a slave master, but in that process, there were also relationships that were formed over the centuries that were consensual and non-consensual, that formed, and people were, children were born, and that's how we have African Americans.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people tend to forget that. People think that sort of mixed race people were born and they disappear and they come up again, they pop up again.
Yes.
And that doesn't happen. And that's really part of the problem within the discussion of mixed race, because for a real good example. People have fought vigorously over, you know, the identity of Barack Obama. But then when they discovered that Michelle Obama herself had a European ancestor, then no one's fighting to have her identify as mixed. And even Obama's children, you know, clearly they have a white grandmother. So, you know, that's the part of the endless problem with race.
I don't know. I don't know whether this is a personal thought, but I'm still trying to understand the context in which in 2019 it's still very difficult for people to talk about perhaps just where their parents are from, you know. And I'm hoping that things are going to get better. You've been doing this for 10 years, you know, and my daughter was born in the year that your website started. And I think, gosh, so what has changed in those 10 years, and perhaps what do we perceive that the changes, hopefully positive, might be for the next 10 years or so in terms of these discussions moving forward?
I think what has to change, I mean, I think right now there are many, many discussions about mixed race, and I should give a mention to the Critical Mixed Race Studies Association, and they've been discussing the mixed race, having a conference since, I believe, 2007, and had their first conference in 2010. So I think that the future for discussing mixed race is very positive. But I think this current political climate that we're in has sort of dampened that, in my opinion.
Thank you so much for your time and for your insights and for your knowledge and for sharing that knowledge with us.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having me on the show. And I just love the fact that we're able to communicate so clearly from so far away.
I know. Actually, it's quite a miracle that this has gone so smoothly, isn't it?
Yes.
Shade.